Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Much Kim Gordon, Steve Bertrand here. It is 12 minutes after 12 o'clock. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's a Monday afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate that. We're going to go straight to California. Big news today. Tim Cook, the Apple CEO, is holding court, and they are announcing it's one of their quasi-annual meetings. They announced different changes, different pieces of hardware and such. Ian Schur writes for CNET, and he is on a phone line with us. Ian, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. You know, everything I'm reading about is the new iPhone size and the iPad, and they're saying, well, Cook might mention the feud with the government, but it sounds like he's starting out that way.
So, well, at the moment where he is that they just started the event about 12 minutes ago, and right now they're actually focusing a lot on their environmental impact. One of the things that Apple's been pushing very hard is the recyclability of their products, the fact that they're made out of aluminum and glass, and that they do as much as they can to make sure that their kind of environmental impact is as little as possible, which is important when you consider how many devices they sell and how many of these things could end up in landfills and how often they encourage us all to upgrade. It's a very mindful thing that they think about this. And they've been criticized in the past by Greenpeace and other organizations because so many people upgrade their devices so often and they end up in landfills. So right now they're actually just talking about their recyclability of their products, the fact that over 90% of their facilities are running on clean energy, and how they recycle their products, because I guess they feel as though people didn't understand as much. So that's where they're going, where they are right now. Odds are that in the next, you know, hour or so that they're talking, they're probably going to be announcing, as you mentioned, a smaller iPhone and also a new iPad that is going to be very similar to the Pro that they released last year. If you remember, we wrote about this on CNET, but they created a larger iPad. It's almost the size of a laptop, but it's super thin, and you can use a keyboard with it, which is one of the things that kind of makes it compete better with normal laptops. So it's an interesting event that they're holding today.
I'm interested in the balance because, you know, Cook, he did say, he's quoted as saying, we have to decide as a society how much power and control our government has over private data. So he did bring it up fairly early on. And
yes,
I'm fascinated in the balance of this because, look, this is a marketing event. He's holding this today to sell more iPhones and iPads. And so this fight with the government is also one that's clearly near and dear to him. But he's got to strike a balance to where he doesn't say too much about privacy because he would, as a CEO, overshadow the marketing of his products that he's announcing today.
Well, that's the thing, right? And Apple is also running up against the fact that the court of public opinion is not entirely with them. About half the country believes that the FBI, that Apple should comply with the FBI. And that means that, you know, instead of where it is in Silicon Valley, where within the 100-mile radius here, pretty much everybody is supporting Apple, and you've got Facebook and you've got Google and all these companies coming out in support of them, around the country it's very different. And so they have to walk this very tight line where they are trying, you know, they still have to sell products, right?
Right,
they can't just be on a political crusade.
He doesn't want the headline tomorrow to be about privacy. He wants it to be about this new, smaller iPhone.
Well, I think he wants both. I think he wants to make – they have been fighting this fight with the FBI in the press, and they have been not shy from getting on the front page and doing interviews with various TV shows. So that – I don't think he's worried about that. He definitely also wants to remind us that Apple makes products and please buy them. So that's there's that very fine line he has to walk, and it's going to be very interesting to see how Apple continues to do this, because this fight with the FBI is not going to end anytime soon, even if after the hearing tomorrow, which we'll have one of our reporters from CNET at that, even after that hearing where the court's going to hear all the arguments about this FBI case, it's still going to go on, and Apple seems to be spoiling for a fight with the Supreme Court.
You know,
so this is going to go further.
I didn't realize till we just started talking. I'm in my own little feud with Apple right now. My son has an iPhone 6, and the screen broke, and we made the mistake of taking it to one of those mall kiosks.
Right.
you know, that, and it didn't work well. So then we went to the Apple store and they wouldn't fix it until the original screen was back on. So,
yes.
You know, they're very particular about that.
They are particular, and they make it, they, you know, for in, to their credit, they do spell it out in your paperwork. Which
I don't read that paperwork.
Where they say that if you change the device in any meaningful way using, you know, not their parts, then you've basically voided their warranty.
So that's
what you run up against, right? There was actually a very famous moment where a lot of people who were using the fingerprint sensors on their iPhones, maybe they had cracked the screen or something, they brought it to a mall kiosk like you did, the guy replaced it, and they also replaced the fingerprint sensor with a, you know, not the one Apple made, but a like one, that suddenly when some people were updating their software, the phone said, this isn't working, and they shut it down.
Well, that's what I told my son, they said, you know, and this new sensor could end up burning up the phone, and then when you hear that, you're in trouble.
Exactly.
Okay, wait, I don't want to talk about my own thing. I forgot about that, but we just got 35 seconds, but I'm interested too. Okay, when they announced this smaller iPhone today, it's not about making something better, right? It's about making it affordable to people who can't afford the bigger ones.
That's the likely answer. And it's not even just in the United States, because a lot of us would say, well, you know, I can afford an iPhone. Most people can. But when you look overseas, you look at China, you look at India, you look at Brazil, that's where it gets really important to have a cheaper iPhone. A couple of years ago, I remember when I was at the Wall Street Journal, we wrote about how the iPhone, the 2 or 3 year old iPhone at that point was one of the most successful products Apple made overseas. And so they definitely need to be mindful about how, you know, yes, you can have a premium, high-end, expensive iPhone that you sell to the Western world, but when you get to other places where that iPhone represents practically an entire year's salary for someone, right, you have to sell something cheaper, and that's what they're going after. And they, you know, so it's going to be interesting to see whether or not this thing succeeds, because the last time they tried doing this, it didn't work very well.
All right, the Apple announcement going on right now. Ian Scher writes for CNET. Listen, Ian, I appreciate you talking to us today, and I hope to do it again soon.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Let's check the traffic hotspots. Here's Dolly McCarthy.
Well, Steve, your expressways and tollways are still looking good out there and all in good shape. We're just keeping an eye still on that crash in Wheaton on County Farm Road in Manchester. Dolly McCarthy, WGN Traffic Central.
Plan your home improvement and DIY project Sunday mornings on WGN TV. Watch House Smarts with Lou Manfredini at 10:30, followed by Weekend Workbench at 11. Well, 1222, you're listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Frank Sennett comes by most Mondays, and he's here this afternoon with a couple of, stories right up my alley. Frank, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
I don't know where to start, if we should start with the mattress stores or the valley. Okay, we'll start with the mattress stores. you know, in my town, I live in Deerfield, and it's these mattress stores are ubiquitous. They're everywhere, and it's as soon as a Blockbuster goes out or another retail store goes out, it seems as if there's always a mattress store that moves in. My wife and I were talking about it this weekend. It's amazing how they can survive. There must be a story there, but there's a story in Cranes about how there might be more pressure on them coming up soon, and they might be going away. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you can't swing a pillowcase without hitting a mattress store.
Waited all day for that.
I wrote that a couple weeks ago. But like you say, there are some market pressures that may lead to fewer corners being inundated with mattress stores. One of those is the just merging of these companies. The two biggest chains, Mattress Firm and Sleepy's, merged just last month in a $780 million deal. And Cranes is hearing that Mattress Firm may close 60 to 80 of its 230 post-merger locations in the Chicago area within the next year. So that'll take some inventory off of these corners. And then the other thing is what's dealing with a lot of retail, a lot of retailers are dealing with in brick-and-mortar sense, is the Internet. There are upstarts such as Tuft & Needle and Leesa, L-E-E-S-A. They're taking market share. They are aiming at millennials and others who are comfortable shopping online. Those are going to put a lot of pressure on those brick-and-mortar mattress stores as well.
I was talking about being up at the mall this weekend, and turns out where I was, Milwaukee and Townline Road, the story by H. Lee Murphy starts out by saying there are 16 mattress stores around that intersection, which is just a phenomenal thing. Now, I don't quite know if I'm willing to buy a mattress online, right? Because isn't the whole thing you're supposed to lay down and sample it?
That would be my preference as well, but maybe it's just because we're old guys.
I think that might be the answer. All right, speaking of old guys, we can't park our car and walk to the restaurant. We need valet. And a story by Peter Frost in ChicagoBusiness.com is about this crackdown on valet parking in Chicago. I had not heard about it until I read this story. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so there's a law in the books in the city of Chicago that has not been enforced very often in the past, saying that the valet folks cannot have those carts out on the sidewalks where they keep the keys and validate the tickets and do the credit card transactions, all that good stuff. That and the signage is not legal, and it's just been something that folks have been doing. You see it at restaurants, at hotels, all over town. Now, for some reason, I don't know if it was driven by a need for more revenue by the city, perhaps. The city has issued more citations all around that lot of LA parking companies in 1 month of 2016 than it did in 2014 and 2015 combined for 2 years. In 1 month, they beat that mark. They issued 76 citations for the quote-unquote storage of goods on public ways violation between February 8th and March 10th, up from 30 in all of 2015 and 42 in 2014. So there is a big crackdown that's going on. The fines are $50 to $250. Valet companies, if they do have their boxes out, they know that they could get a ticket every day.
Well, here's the thing. When there's crackdowns like this, though, Frank, you usually get a warning. Right? Going to clean this up. And that didn't seem to come from the city this year.
Did not happen. And also, there's no way to get legal. There's not a permit that you can buy
crazy.
To have the box out there. So, you know, the people, the restaurateurs and the hotels, et cetera, that have taken away, the valets have taken away those boxes, people drive up, where's your valet? And then the restaurateur says, hey, you know, they're there, but they can't have the signs and the boxes out by city law. And then the person says, well, I just saw one up the street. So consumers are confused. The valet people are up in arms. So there's trade groups are trying to push against this. The Illinois Restaurant Association, the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association, they were meeting with the city to see if there was some way to head off this aggressive enforcement.
Yeah, it seems crazy. And of all the things, you'd think you'd want a couple more people on the street. But we'll follow that. Frank, very much for appreciate you joining us today. Thank you very much for that.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We're going to take a break, and after the news, a pretty cool book by a guy named Todd Rose. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, what's the average millennial's take on politics, or how does the average baby boomer react to new technology in the workplace? I have an idea. Those might be forbidden questions in Harvard professor Todd Rose's world. His new book is called The End of Average, and he joins us now to explain himself. Professor, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, how did I do? Are those questions the sorts of things where, I mean, maybe that's not exactly what you're writing about, but in a way, when it comes to averages, you argue that we're overplaying things a bit.
Yeah, that's right. I think that my claim would be that, you know, averages have a place, but when it comes down to trying to think about individuals, whether it's someone we're trying to hire or assess performance, that using group averages fails pretty miserably.
I love this. I want you to tell me about this 19th century guy, Adolf, is it Quetelet?
Quetelet. Yeah.
Quetelet, okay. Who knew that the BMI index goes back to the 19th century? But tell me about Quetelet.
Yeah, so Quetelet is the guy that actually invents the average man. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was written on stone tablets, you know. But no, he was an astronomer. Back in the early 19th century, and astronomy makes use of averages a lot, and they're pretty useful there. And they were living through the era of census data for the first time, and people are trying to make sense of society. And he's the first person that decides, hey, what we should do is stop thinking about individuals because they're way too messy, and just focus on this average person that emerges when you smush everyone together, basically. And he took it one step further, which is, he thought the average wasn't just a mathematical idea, but that it was like divine, like it was perfection.
But the thing is, it was a whole new way of thinking, you know. I mean, we now, it, you know, it's nothing new to say the average person does this or the group does this. But at that time, the idea, I mean, talk to me a little bit about what he did with the numbers with suicide, because he looked at those and came up with this idea of an average that seemed to be sort of shocking to people at that time.
Yeah. So when he starts calculating averages on everything he could get his hands on, and he finds that in Belgium the suicide rate was pretty stable on average from year to year. And, you know, to us that seems, yeah, okay, fine.
Right, we'd accept that. We'd expect it.
Yeah, it was people just, their minds just, like, blown. Like, how could something so private and irrational like suicide be stable? But then, of course, Quetelet decides that it turns out that the average man was suicidal to an average extent. So we all had some suicidal propensity.
The name of your book is The End of Average, so I would imagine you're making the argument that this is a bad idea and that we should measure ourselves in different ways. Explain for me what those different ways would be.
Yeah, so basically when we think about how we measure ourselves, we think about three basic principles of individuality, right, to understand ourselves. The first is what we call jaggedness. So if this idea of that the characteristics we care about, like size and, you know, talent and things like that, are always multidimensional, and you're going to have a collection of strengths and weaknesses, every single person. So it means you can't reduce someone to a single score. So, you know, but we do that all the time, right? Like, we admit people to schools based on SAT scores and things like
right,
that.
Right, right.
So we push for more multidimensional assessments, and there's plenty of good examples of that. The second one is context principle, that you really can't talk about performance or talent independent of the immediate environment. And so things like job descriptions, right, must be a good communicator. No one's just generically a good communicator, right? So you need to contextualize the performance you're looking for. The final one we call the pathways principle, which is that people differ in the pace and sequence with which they achieve goals, and it's guaranteed that there's always more than one right pathway to get to a successful outcome. So things like career ladders really make no sense.
But the thing is, Todd, is that it seems to me that those averages and finding the typical and finding what SAT score fits well for your institution, it's a great shortcut. And without those shortcuts, it seems like we could be working forever and never get to the results we need.
It does feel a little bit like if you let go of those familiar notions that it would be kind of anarchy, right? Like,
sure.
Or just really complex. But actually what we find is it's that when you actually look at your specific context, so in my book I talk about, you know, a whole range of companies that have actually shifted from averages to individuality, they actually find metrics pretty quickly that are predicting how individuals do in their company. And so, for example, Google found that SAT scores actually don't predict at all, and yet they had been relying on that for a decade. So in fact, while it might be a little more complicated sometimes, you know, the false simplicity of a one-dimensional score, the trade-off isn't worth it, right? You're hiring the wrong people.
So, you know, it strikes me as I'm talking to you that maybe I'm talking a little bit like the people did in Quetelet's time when they were aghast by suicide numbers. I mean, I'm sitting here saying, how could we ever do it any differently? And that's what Quetelet introduced to us in the 1900s.
Yeah, and I think we all are grappling with it, right? We're so used to a whole entire society that's been built around average, right? It's either how close you approximate it or how far you can get above it, right, that matters. And so for generations, we've not thought of ourselves in any other way. But the truth is, in all aspects of our society, we're shifting, and we know it doesn't work, and we're shifting to something different. So I don't know a single person who's happy with average-based medicine, right? You want to show up and have your doctor understand your health and diseases on your terms.
All right, so is this the science of individuality that we're talking about?
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a paradox, right? A science of individuality. But in fact, this is where in every field that deals with human beings, in medicine and human performance, where we've gotten access to bigger data, we've realized that when you start by averaging everything out, it often creates insights that apply to nobody at all.
Right.
And so instead what we do is we look at individual patterns and we group from there. And so every breakthrough in, say, cancer research in the last decade has come from this new approach.
What do you tell someone then who's running an HR department or a CEO of a company and they're confronted with this, the idea that average doesn't exist and sort of building for average or expecting average is no way to operate a business? How do they begin to turn that around?
Yeah, no, it seems like a monumental task. And what I would say is that there are actually incredible bright spots out there, companies that are doing this and actually consulting firms that are doing this. But until you get rid of this average-based lens, you don't see them. They're on the fringe. For example, you want to hire someone better? There's a group, the Lou Adler Group, invented performance-based hiring, which simply states, define the contextualized performance you want, then find the people that can do that. It seems so obvious, right? They're just absolutely crushing it in terms of success rates. And so you could hire someone different right there. You want to assess, yearly reviews, look at what Deloitte's doing, getting rid of one-dimensional scoring into four simple questions. So there's all kinds of better ways to do things, but the mindset thing is going to be the thing that holds us back.
Is this the beginning of a fundamental change in the way we measure ourselves? I mean, do you see this accelerating and becoming normal 50, 60 years from now?
Yeah, I do, because I think there's the economic driver, right, for this kind of knowledge-based economy have, where we need more and more kinds of talent. I think we have the moral imperative in medicine to get to personalized medicine, and we have an education system where the public now thinks the goal is to nurture the talent of every individual kid rather than batch process.
Yeah, I could talk to you about education forever, too. You want to throw out the idea of a diploma.
Oh, it makes absolutely no sense that everyone goes to college and stays there for the exact same amount of time, and you get some undifferentiated diploma when it's such a fuzzy signal to employers. I'm a big believer in competency-based credentials.
Yeah. So the idea is you would get you'd get a certificate in marketing or in economics in general, and you might do it at your own pace, because rather than the average number of seat hours you need to master a subject, each person does it at their own speed. They might do some parts of it very quickly and others of it very slowly. So why judge everyone by one time frame, by one number of hours in a classroom on a subject?
Yeah, and, look, I work at a university. I know why it's easier for us,
yeah,
right? Like,
right.
I get it. But if it's about creating systems that allow each person to develop to their full potential, it just doesn't make any sense, right?
It'd be chaos, Todd. How could you be a third-year student when it could be a 12-year program?
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's our job to figure out how to be flexible around that. And I think that the talent results that we'll see as a society will make it worth it.
I've got faith in you. Harvard professor Todd Rose, the name of the book, The End of Average. Listen, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Orion and Kim. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN 1252. And, we started the day talking about Apple's announcements, the smaller phone. In fact, they talked a little bit more about government and privacy and all of that. Jim Dahlke is here from Chicago Inno. And, Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome back to the program. I guess I should say Jim Dahlke and Will Flanagan are fixtures here, and I'm grateful for that. But so you walk by, and you're like, what's going on Pioneer Court here? Because there's industrial construction going on.
I totally forgot that. Yeah, they're putting the Apple Store
there. It's the Apple Store that they're building right outside the window. So, in fact, there's Tim Cook with a hammer right now.
He just gave a shout-out to Grubhub, actually, during his little announcement. Yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah. Grubhub has an app for the Apple TV, so you can order food from your TV now.
Are you an Apple TV proponent?
I don't have it, but I'm in the market for one. I'm ready to sort of cut the cable cord, and I'm interested in Apple TV or Chromecast or some sort of non-cable option.
All right, help me. Why? I would be happy to cut the cable cord. What would Apple TV do for me?
So Apple TV is going to do a lot of things for you. First of all, it's sort of bringing apps to your TV, which is kind of like the revolution that Apple thinks it's going to have. And so basically it's going to have on-demand options, some streaming options, and then sort of bring apps to the television. So that's going to open up a lot of things in the future. For me, there's not really enough there live TV-wise for me to make the switch to Apple TV. But I think as soon as Apple or somebody else figures out live sports, that's going to be the first thing that sort of triggers me to cut the cable cord.
That's not why you're here, is it?
Yes, we're talking tech.
Today is a big day at Channel 7. Jerry Taff will be riding a brand new radar into the sunset.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I don't know if you've been watching ABC7's promos over the last month or so, but
Did they have the Super Bowl? Was it the?
So I think it's during the Oscars? It's been the last month or so that they've been teasing this sort of brand new radar technology, and it's always sort of sound very interesting. And actually, the 4 p.m. Newscast tonight, you're going to see it officially unveil, and it is called the Live Doppler 7 Max, and it's a very, very intimidating name. And basically, it's a brand new radar technology that ABC7 is going to use. It's the first commercial broadcast technology for a broadcast news station. The military and the National Weather Service were really only using it before, and they're going to be the first news channel to
have it. So Channel 7, I mean, you know, they got criticized for going a little over the top with their teases and all of that. But there is something unique to this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a little silly. But you know what? It's, for me, somebody like me, you know, I don't watch the news a lot, but when I do, it's for the weather. So if you're going to go all in on something, you might as well go in all on your weather technology. And basically, right, what this new radar system is going to do, it's just basically improves the clarity and the accuracy of their weather predictions, so they can look at storms from further away with more accuracy, can kind of take it down onto the street level and sort of pinpoint weather down to more on that street level predicting. So it's basically a smarter weather technology that really has never existed at a broadcast news station before. So it's really interesting to see them sort of double down on that kind of technology for local news.
And they're going to start using it this afternoon.
Yep, 4 p.m. broadcast tonight, so we'll have to tune in and see what exactly, you know, kind of how they brand it and how they use it. But
we don't have any storms in the area today.
Yeah, just a little chilly, but nothing too crazy to track.
Can they show
today.
Cold? They probably can't show cold with that radar.
It sounds like it's mostly just storms, so it's like taking a look at the storm swell, yeah.
So they bring this new technology, this innovative piece of equipment, and people will watch them for a week or so, and then they'll realize Tom Skilling still has the better weather. Right?
I guess so. Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. And I mean, like I was saying, you know, the weather is really the one thing that I'll still like to watch on the TV,
well,
except
for
my phone.
I think, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but you know, Channel 9 has built an entire 10 o'clock newscast now off of the weather and Tom Skilling. That's how they market it. You know, first with the weather at 10 o'clock, so I think that is bread and butter for them.
Yeah, when you're explaining the news, I still like that explanation of here's what you can expect in your 7 days. I mean, I can get the rundown of the news pretty much on Twitter or just on my phone.
You know I do news here, right? I'm a radio news guy.
No, I don't, because I saw it on my phone earlier.
Oh, thanks very much for that. All right, Jim, thanks for making the dash across the river.
Yeah, of course.
And listen, bring Tim Cook some lemonade as you go across.
Will do.
At the construction site there for the Apple Store. That's Jim Dahlke. He writes for Chicago Inno, and maybe we'll have you and Will in later this week, if not certainly next week.
Yeah, happy to do it.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's going to wrap things up for The Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. I do appreciate it. And I hope you'll follow me on Facebook and on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is at Steve Bertrand, and just Steve Bertrand on Facebook. And I want to say special welcome as well to Michael Heidemann. Michael is the new producer of The Business Lunch, and everyone wave at him now. Okay, he sees it. He appreciates it. So he's waving back. Can you tell? Michael Heidemann, the producer of The Business Lunch. He's the guy you'll likely talk to if you email or give us a call. All right, it's 1 o'clock. You heard the tone there. Time for a check of the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago.